Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. I'm your host, Guy Schaefer. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, to start off, Mark Dunley speaks with Mary Lister, a home health care worker and an organizer with the Queen City Worker Center, about the campaign against wage theft in New York State. Then on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory speaks with Melanie Evans, the interim director of the Dudley Observatory in Schenectady, New York. After that, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaks with longtime labor organizer Saladin Mohammed of the Southern Workers Assembly and Black Workers for Justice about the outlook of Black workers in the South struggling for the right to unionize. Then Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Victoria Whalen of New York Renews about the New York State Climate and Community Investment Act. Then McKenna Connors speaks with Michelle Rogat, graduate student and sustainability planner, who will be speaking about energy infrastructure at the upcoming Sustainable Futures Conference. And to close out the show, Corinne Carey speaks with Layla Kios, owner of the bar, entertainment center, and delectable ice cream shop, The Yard and Boozy Moose in Albany. But first, here are the headlines. Another protest against police brutality will take place in Townsend Park in Albany at 1 p.m. Saturday, April 17th, following Wednesday's pepper spraying of protesters outside the police station in South End. On Monday, April 19th, the City Common Council is scheduled to vote on whether to ban police department use of tear gas, which, despite being widely used by U.S. law enforcement, has been recognized as a war crime for nearly a century. The number of workers filing new claims for unemployment benefits hit a 13-month low, the U.S. Labor Department reported Thursday, in the latest sign the job market is rebounding. The number of claims filed in the week ending April 10th totaled 576,000, the lowest figure since the 256,000 claims March 14th, 2020. The Times Union reports that Capital District seasonal employers are scrambling to find workers for the summer. Meanwhile, the Dow Jones average climbed above 34,000 for the first time. The accident at the Sitterley Northway Pass near Exit 9 is expected to cause traffic disruptions for a week, causing long delays on nearby Route 9. The Gazette reports that the Rotterdam Town Board has set a virtual hearing for 7 p.m. on April 28th to consider whether the town should have a moratorium on short-term rentals like Airbnbs. Some residents say they feel unsafe not knowing who is living next to them. The town attorney is looking into whether the town can vote on the moratorium after the public hearing. Union College plans to hold outdoor graduation ceremonies in June for students in both its current graduating class and last year's class, offering two separate ceremonies for the roughly 500 graduates in each class. The main site will not allow visitors beyond the graduates under recently released state guidelines for graduation events, but Union plans to allow each graduate two ticketed guests who can join a separate outdoor on-campus location to view a live stream of the ceremony. And Assembly Judiciary Committee Chairman Charles Levine, who is leading the Assembly's impeachment investigation, confirmed they're reviewing reports relating to the publishing of the governor's memoir last year, in addition to allegations of sexual harassment, COVID-19 reporting in nursing homes, and reported defects on the construction of the Mario Cuomo Bridge. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's @mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390, that's 518-272-2390. Each year, more than $1 billion is stolen from the paychecks of low-income workers in New York. A coalition of workers and community groups worked for years to pass the SWEAT bill to address the problem, only to have Cuomo 2 years ago veto the bill on New Year's Day. April 12th saw statewide actions targeting Cuomo. We talk with Mary Lister, a home health care worker and an organizer with the Queen City Worker Center, by Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Joined now by Mary Lister, who's with the Queens City Worker Center out in Buffalo. She's both a staff organizer with him and has also been a home care worker. And this Tuesday was a statewide day of action around the issue of wage debt and the sweat bill. But Mary, why don't we just start off talking a little bit about, you know, what is the Queen City Worker Center and why you all care concerned about the issue of wage debt?
Sure, Mark. We are a worker center made up of working class people from all different industries and all different backgrounds. And many of the workers who organize with us are service workers or are other workers who have experienced high degrees of wage theft. So, you know, here in Buffalo, wage theft is a really big issue. There was a report that came out a few years ago that showed that about 2/3 of low-wage workers in Buffalo faced some kind of wage theft at their current job. And we believe that during the pandemic, this has only gotten worse. And so we feel that the sweat bill is necessary because what we're seeing, unfortunately, is that even when workers do decide to speak up against this wage theft and to come forward and try to get that money back, that the laws are so weak that oftentimes the bosses can just hide their assets and get away with not paying back the workers. So we feel that the sweat bill is a really important tool to encourage workers to come forward, come together, and actually give them the possibility of winning back some of what they're owed.
Now, I know that I believe it's the National Employment Law Project did a study a number of years ago, which estimated wage theft throughout the state, primarily from low-income workers, is more than $1 billion a year. So, and you mentioned 2/3 of low-income workers, you know, have seen some wage theft in Buffalo. What are some of the, you know, situations that, you know, you have heard about in Buffalo or experienced?
So I have experienced wage theft as a home care worker where my check was once shorted by about $200. But, you know, we've seen many high profile cases, especially in the service industry here in Buffalo. And something interesting about the cases that are coming out here in Buffalo is sometimes, you know, people who think that wage theft shouldn't be seen as that big of a deal, sometimes they'll paint wage theft as sort of an accident where a mom and pop restaurant might accidentally not pay their workers the correct amount and really might not have much of a profit margin to be working with in the first place. And, you know, of course, I don't think wage theft is okay under any circumstances, but I think that the cases we're seeing in Buffalo are so important because it really challenges that narrative. For example, one of the most recent cases was Hotel Henry, which is, you know, a very high class, well-known, expensive restaurant and hotel. And they are currently undergoing litigation from former workers who say that they committed lots of wage theft against the workers. And this is just the latest in a series of local wage theft cases involving some of, you know, the most well-known and the most well-known Buffalo establishments that really cater to, you know, some of the wealthier members of the Buffalo community. So, for example, Row House was one of the first cases to come out into the public eye a few years ago. And since then, it's just continued where, you know, many of these restaurants that, you know, rake in money have continued to be found guilty of wage theft.
So, you know, I spent about a decade ago, 7 years working in New York City and became quite active with the wage theft issue, particularly this group called En Masse, National Mobilization Against Sweatshop. And one of the things they pointed out in New York City was even when they would, the workers would win an order from the Department of Labor requiring the boss to pay back wages, you know, they play games like, oh, I no longer own the place. You know, it's owned by my uncle or, you know, some other relative. You know, are there similar type of games that have been played in Buffalo where, you know, the owners try to, you know, basically evade even when you win an order for wage restoration that they try to avoid having to actually pay?
Unfortunately, yes, we are seeing that here where the bosses will oftentimes shut down the restaurant and move around their assets. So we first saw this with Protocol Restaurant. They faced charges both on the state and federal level. They had some EEOC complaints against them. as well as some wage theft complaints through the Department of Labor. And they had started to pay back some of those Department of Labor claims. They did not get anywhere close to paying the full amount that they owed the workers. And then they since shut down and have made it much harder for the workers to get back that money that they're legally owed.
Now, I know this is a, you know, at least a 7-year effort at this point to pass this sweat bill to deal with wage theft. And it took 4 or 5 years of trying to negotiate with various members of the Assembly and Senate committees and change the bill to deal with their objections. And finally, the bill was passed 2 years ago. And then literally on New Year's Day, the last possible day, you know, Governor Cuomo, you know, vetoed the bill. Has there been any effort by the governor? You know, he said, oh, I don't really oppose the bill. I want to tweak it a bit. Has there been any effort by the governor to, you know, push through a compromise in the state legislature to solve this issue?
There really has not been a good faith effort on the side of Governor Cuomo. His aides had put out a, you know, suggestion of a wage theft bill, I believe in 2019 or right around the time that he did veto SWEAT. But there was a lot of issues with his bill. So for example, he wanted to severely limit who could be held responsible for the wage theft. So under his proposed bill, it would just be the owner. It would not be able to involve any other management. Also, in order to place the lien, they would have to be, basically the court would have to take a look and decide that the wage theft had merit. So in other words, there were so many roadblocks in his proposed version that it really would take the power out of SWEAT. And we feel that, the protections that we're asking for under SWEAT are really just the same thing that we currently have under the mechanics law, but making those protections available to more workers. And, you know, that law has been very successful. And so we feel that, you know, all workers should have those, that power to be able to get back their wages when they've been stolen.
If people are not familiar with the mechanics law, you know, I know it particularly from the construction industry because my brother at one point was a builder. But, you know, if there's a dispute when you're doing a project, you know, they can place a lien, against the property, and that puts a little bit more extra pressure to come, you know, to some type of a settlement. Now, I know in Buffalo, Crystal People Stoke, deputy speaker of the state assembly, is from Buffalo and is quite powerful. Used to be with Citizen Action. Has she weighed in, or, you know, what's been the response from the Buffalo delegation to this issue?
It has been hard to get local legislators to really weigh in on this subject. Senator Tim Kennedy, who's also from the Buffalo area and who has been, you know, in the legislature for a while, he did vote in favor of the SWEAT bill, which we appreciate. But we, you know, it has been hard to get, widespread support for this on behalf of the legislators. I think partly because, you know, Cuomo really kind of made his line when he did veto the SWEAT bill. But we're hopeful that this year, you know, when it's clear that Cuomo does not have the popular support that he once did, we're hopeful that legislators will really step up to not only pass the SWEAT bill, but if Cuomo were to veto it again, we hope that they would override that decision.
So we've been talking with Mary Lister from the Queen City Worker Center, both a staff organizer and a home care worker. If people want to, you know, find out more about the SWEAT campaign, how best can they, you know, get informed and express their opinion?
If you would like to let Governor Cuomo know that you really are in favor of the SWEAT bill, then I would encourage you to contact him by phone and leave him a message letting him know your support. And his number is 518-474-8390.
We've been talking with Mary Lister, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was HMM's Mark Dunley speaking with Mary Lister, a home health care worker and organizer with the Queens City Workers Center. Up next on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory speaks with Melanie Evans, the interim director of the Dudley Observatory in Schenectady, New York. In this segment, they discuss the women computers who charted the skies of Dudley as human computers.
Once again, welcome to another segment of Reclaiming History with Livonia Mallory. We have a very exciting conversation we're going to have today, and my listeners are going to have the opportunity to tune in. To my guests, please share with my listeners your name and what you do at Dudley.
Hi, I'm Melanie Evans, and I am the interim executive director for Dudley Observatory. So for right now, I'm the administrative force for Dudley, making sure that in the quote-unquote unprecedented times, that Dudley is running smoothly and all our operations are continuing through COVID before we begin relaunching for all of our new programming.
So, you know, I really was very excited to have you on because Dudley has a very interesting history. And the history of Dudley is really very much related to women in science. Tell my listeners a little bit about the history of the Dudley Observatory and female scientists.
So the history of Dudley is long. Dudley has actually been in the Capital area in Albany since 1856. So I always find this really entertaining. This is before the Civil War. At the time, there was a lot of interest in creating an area of learning, almost competition to the European universities and colleges in the Albany area. There was a lot of goods trafficking through Albany. It was very comparable to Boston in terms of being a metropolitan area. And there was a lot of interest, and we're going to create a massive university, an area of learning. And really what came out of those thoughts, the really only thing that launched was the Dudley Observatory. And it was actually due to a woman that it did launch. So Blandina Dudley, she was the widow of Charles Dudley, who was a New York politician. She donated over $100,000 in memory of her husband to basically get the Dudley Observatory started. And construction began in 1852 on Goat Hill, and that observatory was inaugurated in 1856. So had to move to a new location eventually in 1893. Mostly what happened is their original site was really awesome, and it was also close to the railroads. And at the time, there was a lot of interest in the accurate cataloging of where stars really were, and you can't accurately catalog where something is if your telescope is rattling around when a train comes by. So moved to its new home on South Lake Avenue in 1893 with a fancy new Brashear telescope, the Prime telescope. And for quite a while after that one, for 65 years after that one, it was the same family for directors. It was Louis Boss and Benjamin Boss who were running the observatory. And their massive project that they undertook was redoing the star catalog. So they were taking measurements, observing stars more accurately, so they could actually have the exact positioning of where particular stars were. And this was a very long project. So it was 30,000 stars. Every hour of observation that they would do on where a star is actually results in 20 hours of mathematical and statistical calculations that had to be done to correctly position it. So with 20 hours of math calculations before actual electronic computers came by, it was people doing the calculations. And they followed the model of Edward Pickering from Harvard and decided that they would hire women as the computers. So the human computers, they would hire women. And their reasoning isn't as altruistic, I guess, as you'd think it'd be. It was fiscally responsible. Is for every star that for some women, they were paid per star. So it was 8 cents a star to do the calculations for it. Other women that they had more regularly on site might be paid 20 cents to 25 cents per hour for all of the huge amounts of mathematical calculations that would be done for these stars. At the time, they employed from about 1900 to 1940 over 81 different women as their computers for Dudley. And that made Dudley basically the largest employer of women in astronomy, or really even in science during that entire period.
So, I mean, this sort of issue of women as computers, I mean, we only know that because of a very recent movie that came out about the development of the NASA rocket, and women were the computers, right? You were a bean counter, essentially, right? And it wasn't a glamorous job. So, of course, women could do it.
The unfortunate part is that women were, I guess, wanted to do it because they could be paid less. However, so even Lewis Voss was quoted as saying that they're as rapid and accurate as men and much more patient. And he actually extolled that their documentation was better than what was produced by the men.
Mm-hmm.
He was certainly happy to have them on the team. But for the ones that worked for Dudley, there's actually very little information known about them. We know that Isabella Ling actually rose to supervisor of the computing core. And there was another woman, she was co-author on a paper on stellar luminosities. But beyond that, we don't have a whole lot of information about the individuals who did all of this work for us. I'm going to assume it's much, much the same for the woman who worked for NASA with their projects as well.
Well, I mean, thank goodness we did have the recent movie. So we do get, we do know that there were several Black women that were involved that were the computers for the NASA program.
And also Harvard. Harvard used women very frequently as well as basically the human computers, doing a lot of mathematical computations as well. There's a fantastic book about all of them as well. But it happened a fair bit in science.
Especially on this math, on this numbering kind of thing with women as the computer. Like, women were the computer. It was actually, before there was a box known as a computer, it was a human being. How gifted were these women? How many were there? And do we have any records of any of them going off and doing something different or doing something else?
So there were, from 1900 to 1940 for Dudley, there were 81 women employed during that period. For the most part, they were high school graduates. So they weren't the ones fighting to get into colleges themselves. There's not a lot of records with regards to them specifically, who they were. And there's a couple of photos out there that have them named, but really the only one that we have, I guess, somewhat more specific records on is Isabella Ling. So she became the supervisor of the computing core, and then she wrote she was co-author on a scientific paper on stellar luminosities, which I think if you do a Google search, you can find that paper. But beyond that, there's not a lot of really specific details on the individuals. They typically didn't stay outstandingly long. This was not a growth position to move up with. You were doing your computations, and that was really it.
So, in a strange way, it's kind of, it gave women an opportunity, but there was a glass ceiling attached to it.
Yes.
Did anything change down the line or in later years? Did women who came into Dudley, did the glass ceiling disappear? Did someone crack the glass ceiling? How did life change for these female computers?
There really isn't much detail about them. There's a lot of detail on the work with the star catalog, the 30,000 of them. It actually led to opening a second observatory. There really isn't that much specific information about the women computers at the time. But for the 1900s or 1940s with our human computers, there's not a lot.
Oh my goodness, we are out of time. I'd like to thank my listeners for tuning in to another segment of Reclaiming History with Livonia Mallory, where we're talking about women computers of the Dudley Observatory. Tune in again for part two of my continuing interview with Melanie Evans, Interim Executive Director of the Dudley Observatory.
And that was HMM's Livonia Mallory speaking with Melanie Evans, Interim Executive Director of the Dudley Observatory in Schenectady, New York. That was part one of a two-part segment. You can hear part two and more at mediasanctuary.org. For those just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer, and you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. You can hear all of the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org. On April 11th, 2021, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry spoke to longtime labor organizer Saladin Mohammed of the Southern Worker Assembly and Black Workers for Justice. In this segment, you'll hear his discussion with Saladin on the outlook of Black workers in the South struggling for the right to unionize, focusing on the Bessemer's Amazon warehouse workers in Alabama who recently lost their election against Amazon for the right to organize a union in the plant. This is part three of a three-part segment.
Now, Saladin, I have just a couple more questions I want to ask you. Now, I know the Southern Worker Assembly, I know y'all probably have been discussing the results of the Amazon struggle. So I just want to ask you, what do you think that labor must do to win these struggles to organize workers in these multinational corporations such as Amazon and Walmart, who employ millions of low-income workers?
Well, again, I think, you know, we have to build organizations inside.
Right.
And we have to, the organizations must begin to exercise concerted activity. You know, they need to begin to mobilize. The self-organization, the workers need to mobilize, you know, themselves, you know, so that the employer is not in a position to so easily say everything was all right until this union came around. He won't let these outsiders, you know, come in and tell you what to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This exists when you don't have self-organization, when you, you know, that kind of thing. You got to build, there's got to be a kind of organic emergence of workers who are fighting against injustices and fighting for change. So I think that's really one aspect of it. We do have to target together some of these big corporations where we need four and five and six major unions that are collaborating to take on these big corporations. No single union by themselves is going to be able to organize Amazon. And so there's got to be a greater collaboration between the unions as a class organization, a class movement, those things. So I think that's a part of it. What we're trying to do in the South and the Southern Workers Assembly through our Southern Workers School is to begin to organize and do education and training about how to build this infrastructure and to initially form workers assembly, Southern Workers Assembly, different locales, local assemblies began to not only reach out into Amazon, but some other corporations or big workplaces in those areas, and to tie them together so that we are building a connecting framework that has begun to target some workplaces and to begin to publicly project these efforts throughout the community so that the struggle in the workplace begins to become feel as an integral part of the community's struggle,
right.
You know. So we think that that's necessary.
And the last question I want to ask you is about what Joe Biden doing, you know, and the AFL-CIO. They put together a bill they called the PRO Act. You heard of that, right?
Yes.
Right. And they said that PRO Act bill would help labor organizing effort. So I just want to know, what are your thoughts on that effort? And do you think,
it would ever get past
the Senate? Go ahead.
Well, again, see, I think, you know, that there's got to be action around the PRO Act. The actions that's connected to the pandemic and to organizing, you know, that really moves action, has got to be the basis of the pressure the push for the COAC, a PRO Act. I mean, you know, this lobbying alone, you understand, ain't going to work. It's going to take some strikes, slowdowns, boycotts for the Congress to have the pressure and for Biden to have the pressure to push for the PRO Act. Everybody's talking about, well, the filibuster this, the filibuster that. Yeah, those are true, but it takes it away from the workers, the worker struggle. This makes it, narrows it down to the processes within government.
Okay. So we got a lot of work to do, huh?
Yeah, we got a lot of work to do. And again, this is going to be some united front aspects of it. But and Biden projects a sense of obligation to the workers and to the black masses. And I think that his coming out to support the right to organize around a period, but you know, at the time that Bessemer was high pointed, you understand, came as a result of the public pressure that he feels, you understand, right, his need to make some support. But again, you know, we welcome that kind of support. But see, those things should come early on, you know, after the petition or that kind of thing. And so sometimes we wait late, like many of the national trade unions. You wait late to maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the vote count. Now, we have to understand, when you say it was a long period, see, this was a mail-in a vote. And so the question of what kind of internal mobilization was taking place against the issues that led these workers to seek unionization in order to have some kind of voice. You know, you got to be fighting against the issues all the way through the union campaign. It's not, you understand, well, wait till we get a union and then we'll have a voice, that kind of thing. The bad conditions, you understand, don't wait until you get a union, and they beat you up right now all the way through. And so PRO Act and all of those things, hopefully the combination of the what the corporations are doing as a result of the pandemic, what the government is doing as a result of the pandemic, what the workers are doing, it's going to be, and how the workers are going to react to that is going to be the test, the litmus test. You know, just waiting, you understand, only to send a petition in. I'm not opposing that, but just to send a petition in to Biden and say, you should do this and you should do that. If he says no, and then we ain't doing nothing beyond that, you understand? You know, if it said workers are striking because Biden refused to even consider the petition or something of that nature, that's another question. Again, that takes work.
Right. And I think it's going to be very important that the labor movement summarize this and critique this particular struggle so they'll know how to do better in the future.
Yes, but again, even that, what we believe is that the rank and file have to lift up that summation, organize that summation, right, organize that discussion. Uh-huh. For in terms of whether the labor tops, those who lead labor from the top, whether they're going to discuss it and sum it up, is questionable. But even if they do sum it up, you understand, we got to wonder, you know, whether they're summing it up from the lens of the labor tops, or whether that then aligns with the summation of the Democratic Party, or whether there's a wider, deeper discussion from the rank and file.
Okay, well, let's leave it there. To be continued, Saladin. We got to discuss this further.
All right.
And all right. Thank you. You know, for the. Oh, by the way, if someone wants to get in touch with the Southern Workers Assembly, you know, you have a email or a website.
Yes, southernworkers.org.
Mm-hmm. They go to southernworkers.org. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's our website. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. All right. Again, thank you, Saladin, for
all
this
right,
well, interview.
Thank you for your work,
and we'll talk again.
All right.
Thanks.
Later.
And that's Saladin Mohammed, co-founder of Black Workers for Justice and the Southern Workers Assembly.
That was H&M's roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, speaking with longtime labor organizer Saladin Mohammed of the Southern Worker Assembly and Black Workers for Justice. You just heard part three of a three-part segment. You can find parts one and two online at mediasanctuary.org. On Wednesday, April 7th, anti-racism and environmental organizers, including New York Renews, Citizen Action, and All of Us, gathered in West Capitol Park to bring attention to the role of racism in the climate crisis and support the Climate and Community Investment Act, the CCIA. The rally was part of a week of action to support the CCIA and the federal Thrive Agenda. Alexis Goldsmith spoke with Victoria Whalen of New York Renews on the New York State Climate and Community Investment Act.
I'm with Victoria Whalen with New York Renews. You spoke at today's rally about the Climate and Community Investment Act. For those who may have never heard of this, what does this act do?
Basically, this is an act that funds the just transition for the people of New York State. It is making polluters pay, and by polluters, I mean corporate polluters and fossil fuel companies, $55 per ton of greenhouse gas emission and other harmful co-pollutants that they put into our communities. And that money will directly go into BIPOC frontline communities, such as community-based organizations. We are funding the care economy, so child independent care, focusing on youth, focusing on greenifying schools, as well as renewable energy, large-scale renewable energy in New York State. So solar arrays, offshore grid and wind, different things like that. It's truly a bill for the people of New York State.
Can you talk more about where the funding will come from?
Sure. So the funding, like I said, will be coming directly from corporate polluters, and by tracking and just things like that, whatever they put into the air that is negative on our health, such as carbon, methane, things like that, we will charge $55 per ton. And in total, that'll be about $15 billion per year that we can invest in New York State. And that's what we mean by renewable economy, because we'll keep getting that money back. And slowly over time, that money will actually increase. So 55 will turn into 60, then 65. So then over time, the billions of dollars we'll get will be put back into our communities.
Can you talk about the anti-racism priorities in this legislation?
Yes, so what I mentioned before when I said defunding the police is the same thing as the CCIA, we truly mean that. None of our money will be going into prison systems, none of our money will be going to, police and any of that related infrastructure, because truly to, free ourselves from this climate crisis, we need to defund structures that, help support it, essentially.
And what's the next step for the bill?
The next step for the bill, so right now we are in recess, which means all the representatives are kind of going home to relax, take a break, and then they're going to be coming right back after this week. And we will be actually having a Senate hearing on April 13th to talk about the CCIA. We'll be having written testimony, public testimony. It is also open to the public. It will be on Zoom. Unfortunately, we cannot go into the beautiful State Capitol building, but it will be on Zoom, and we will be advocating for the CCIA to hope it gets passed this legislative session, which would end in about June. So hopefully it works out.
And how can people join the town hall this Friday?
People can join the town hall this Friday by going to New York Renews at any of our social media. So Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We are posting tons of information about it. You can also go to our Action Network, which will have the registration and RSVP information, and you will get a Zoom link, and it'll all be good to go.
Sounds great. And then how can people support the Climate and Community Investment Act?
People can support in a numerous of ways. They can follow us on our social media handles. They can go to the events that we're at, such as the rallies. We also do a ton of lobbying. So if you think your representative, might want to sign on, lobby for them, call them, email them, let them know that, hey, I think you would be a great person to add to additional support for the CCIA. Small things like telling your friends, telling your family, telling your coworkers, emailing them, just spreading the word is essentially the best way to get involved with the CCIA.
And Michaela did an amazing speech on climate justice, but is there any comment that you'd like to make on climate justice?
Climate justice is racial justice. I feel like that's just self-explanatory. If we want to really change the planet, we need to look at our race relations with each other and truly help those who are impacted most. And I'll just say it again, climate justice is racial justice.
And anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
Let's get the CCIA passed. Hashtag pass the CCIA.
Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You just heard Victoria Whalen of New York Renews on the New York State Climate and Community Investment Act. For HMM, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
That was HMM's Alexis Goldsmith speaking with Victoria Whalen of New York Renews during a rally that took place on April 7th. Up next, Michelle Rogat, graduate student and sustainability planner, talks with McKenna Connors about energy usage, infrastructure, and sustainability efforts. Rogat will be speaking about all this and more at the Sustainable Futures Conference, April 27th through April 30th, which will explore what a just transition means in our region.
Thank you so much for agreeing to be interviewed. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, no, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. So what's your work and how is it related to the field of sustainability?
So my name is Michelle Rogat. I am currently getting my master's in urban and regional planning at UAlbany, focused on energy and sustainability specifically. Currently I am part of the Climate Smart Community Task Force for the City of Troy. So I'm working on, currently we're looking into community choice aggregation, among other things. And I'm deep into writing my master's paper right now to graduate.
Wow, good luck with your master's.
Thanks.
So what does a green recovery in the Capital Region look like to you?
To me, a green recovery, well, I mean, really first, for a recovery for the economy and for the region, really, we need to help people where they are. And a lot of the times I feel like energy is sort of left out of that equation. We don't think about, I mean, sometimes we do, but not to the extent we could think about people's energy bills, their utility bills. Right now, because of COVID, people are $40 billion behind in the country on their utility bills, and that's in arrears. And, you know, that could come due or it could be forgiven if the government, federal government steps in with assistance. But in the meantime, we as local governments, we and a region, we should really be looking into ways we can help people address the issue to begin with in terms of energy efficiency of their home, their energy use, what options they have available, and the role that local governments can really play in that. Right now, when people pay their energy bills, it mostly that money gets exported out of the region to utility companies or power generators, usually. And instead, we could help them save money. And then that money that's saved could be going towards other things locally within our local economy. So that's one way. And I would really like to see that conversation really grow and develop.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Especially since energy has become so essential to modern living.
Yeah.
So what's our region's greatest asset in terms of sustainable planning?
I think one of our greatest assets is that we have Capital District Regional Planning Commission. And through them and a state program, communities have climate smart community task forces within their local governments. So they're all separately working on a lot of the same issues. And so I think collectively, we would have a much better our efforts would make a much better impact if we were working collectively and collaboratively as a region moving forward. And I think there's a lot of interest and that's one of our biggest assets.
Yeah, definitely. So what conversations or work would you like to see come out of the sustainability conference?
More of a regional conversation, like I said. It's rare that, recently, I'm also on a nonprofit that recently started called Capital District Community Energy. And we started as a volunteer group to help research and inform local governments working on doing community choice aggregation. And we represent, several different communities throughout the region. And we realized that we are working on a lot of the same things. And I feel like moving forward, it would be really good if we had more of an established forum to discuss with each other what we're working on instead of just with the resources provided by CDRPC or, you know, NYSERDA, but with each other, and it could be really helpful.
Yeah. Do you want to talk more about like what your organization does, the one that you're working with?
So right now, we don't have any funding or resources. We are still in the process of fully becoming a nonprofit, but we research into what community choice aggregation is, and it is the ability for a municipality, once they pass a law, to be able to aggregate their residents' utility accounts, and then through a community choice administrator, a CCA administrator, help go to the market for better residential or small commercial utility rates, energy rates, but also better options in terms of renewable energy and clean energy. And there are different ways to go about it, and we're researching it right now. We're waiting for NYSERDA, the New York State Energy and Research Development Authority. Next month, they are coming out with their mechanism for selling renewable energy credits, which is the environmental attributes of like community solar that exists, or hydropower or wind power that exists. And that is separate from the power itself. And those prices increased a lot over the past year, and mostly because the state is trying to reach their renewable energy goals. So they increased demand for the renewable energy credits by the state needing to procure it themselves. So the voluntary market, us, we are also being affected by those prices. And right now, with everyone going through economic hardships, it would be hard to convince local governments to adopt 100% renewable energy if it would increase residential and small commercial utility costs. And that's something that we don't want to do, especially right now. And there are other ways of doing it. So we're looking into that. That's part of the things that we're doing.
That was HMM's McKenna Connor speaking with Michelle Rogoff, who will be leading the breakout session in Reimagining Our Energy Consumption as part of the Sustainable Futures Conference, which will be taking place from April 27th through 30th. To find more information, you can go to www.sustainablefuturesconference.com. Layla Kios, owner of the bar, entertainment center, and delectable ice cream shop, The Yard and Boozy Moose in Albany, talked to HMM correspondent Corinne Carey about opening her business days before the COVID-19 shutdown and how she adapted.
Layla, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to talk to you.
Can you tell me about your business in downtown Albany?
My business is called The Yard Hatchet House and Bar. An indoor yard. That's the best description I could give it, because that's how the idea came to mind. At The Yard, we have a really cool bar. We have a large indoor turf to play lawn games on. And then we also have 4 cages for axe throwing. What I was attempting to do with it was capture that feeling of fun that you have in your own backyard, but to bring it inside. And so there's elements within the yard that make you feel like you're kind of in the outdoors. I have a wall with 100 living plants, so there's like a lot of green space. My bar is designed to look like a bunch of firewood stacked. In addition to plenty to do, it's a fun space to hang out because there's a lot of interesting things to look at.
You mentioned axe throwing, and I have to say, I've actually been to The Yard, and my husband and I did some axe throwing, and it's a great way to kind of get out some pent-up aggression. Where did you come up with the idea of doing axe throwing, and what reaction do you get?
So people are always surprised that you can go to a place, especially a place that has alcohol, and throw axes. The idea really came to me about 4 years ago. Axe throwing had started to become a thing in other areas in the country, but nothing local. And I thought it would be a lot of fun and something interesting to bring to downtown, especially because at that particular time, there was a lot of conversation about trying to revitalize downtown to make it a place where people wanted to return to live, instead of just making it sort of a place that people went to go to work and then go home. Over time, that idea kind of expanded because I didn't want to just make it about axe throwing. I wanted to make it about things that people don't really have access to when they live in like a downtown area. You know, people don't have access to backyards. So I wanted to try to capture that and bring in those elements to downtown Albany, where you could walk into my space in February and still have outdoor fun, but inside. Axe throwing, it's a very good way to relieve stress and just get out some overall aggression, because, you know, the past year has just been just tumultuous and terrible for so many people.
And it's been tumultuous and terrible for businesses, particularly businesses like bars and places where people gather. How were you able to weather this past year?
You know, initially I was shut down from March until June. In that time, I wasn't sure that we were ever going to really be able to reopen. You know, I certainly understand the state's desire to bring everything to a pause, assess the situation, and kind of figure out what can we safely do. But it was a very terrible period in that time when I had no idea what was going to become of my business, because I opened the yard on the heels of that shutdown. My grand opening was March 13th. The shutdown came March 16th. So for me, you know, this was everything that I had. I mean, I had worked on this for 3 years, and then to suddenly have it yanked away from me over something that I had no control over or nothing to do with. So I would say between March and June, there was a period where I was just trying to figure out what I was going to do once we could reopen, if we could reopen. You know, I had a lot of alcohol and nothing to do with that alcohol. So I make ice cream at home. I really like ice cream. So in this time period when everybody's home baking, I'm making ice cream and thinking about my bar and all the alcohol behind it that I can't do anything with. So I started putting it in my ice cream and then just slowly kind of created these recipes with alcohol and created this brand called Boozy Moo, and it's alcohol infused ice cream. So the way that I got the yard reopened in phase two, when really all you could do as a bar is takeout and outdoor seating, was I drew people in with this ice cream. And then September, October were steady and okay. And then, you know, in November, we went into that holiday surge. I thankfully could stay afloat. I was fortunate that I got some of the SBA disaster relief, and I was able to take advantage of some of the grants that were provided by the SBA and the City of Albany and Capitalize Albany. So that was helpful. But, you know, to weather this storm, I had to do a lot of things by myself. I didn't really have any staff because they were at home and they didn't feel comfortable coming back to work or what have you. Also, financially, it was hard to kind of try to bring in staff when you're only partially operating. And then, you know, came January, and January we started to see improved sales and things were starting to kind of improve overall, because vaccines were rolling out and all of that. And then suddenly in February, the Liquor Authority came in and started shutting down all of the axe throwing bars, telling the bars that axe throwing has never been permitted during the pandemic, which came as a complete shock because I had been operating by that point for 8 months. The SLA knew what my business model was, and they had been into my space to do a COVID check and had given me high marks and basically said, you know, you're compliant. So to then be told in February that in fact, no axe throwing is permitted was a bit of a shock. I was shut down for about 3 weeks, but it wasn't just solely me. I mean, they had gone to any bar that had axe throwing and kind of told them the same thing.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Layla Kios from The Yard in Albany. How were you able to resolve that? Were you ever able to get them to change their determination, or did you just remain shut down during that entire surge period?
When they had said no more axe throwing, the only thing I was operating at that time was my bar and, you know, my drink and food service. Outside on my patio, I had constructed these greenhouses that each have a different theme. So all winter long, I had been running these greenhouses, which are essentially private party rooms. So I could still operate the greenhouses, which that was a godsend because they're very popular. You know, when the SLA came to me and said, you're not permitted to do axe throwing, and I asked them to tell me what they were basing that on, they had pointed to some of Governor Cuomo's executive orders, which when you looked at them, those orders were not saying what we were told they were saying. So essentially what I did is I hired an attorney and I sued them because I have no problem with common sense restrictions, but I just think it's wrong to kind of come in, especially 8 months into things, and to say, oh, you can't be doing this and you were never allowed to do this, when clearly that wasn't the case. So I sued them, and I think I sued them on a Friday in federal court. And then on Tuesday, I received word that the governor's office was reversing course and essentially saying that, yes, you can do axe throwing. It was incredibly frustrating. It was incredibly expensive, you know, not only to hire an attorney to pursue our right, but the revenue loss. And it was just a nightmare. Those 3 weeks were another period of uncertainty that I had to contend with. Axe throwing resumed on March 5th. And so now you can come into the yard and we're open for all of our activities. You know, of course, we operate pursuant to the guidelines. And, you know, I've always had strict enforcement of those guidelines. And I think that's one of the reasons why I've never had a single case of COVID traced back to the yard. I've never been infected, and none of my staff. So I encourage people to come and check out my place. But of course, you know, I am going to enforce the COVID rules.
Well, I want to go back to Boozy Moos for a second, because I think that deserves a little bit more attention. Delicious. And I just want to know if you can tell our listeners what some of the flavors are and what's your favorite.
My personal favorite is the one called Samurai Futaba. I'm partial to that because that was one of the first ones that I made, and I really like ginger. So that one is a ginger ice cream with Japanese whiskey. It's a great Japanese whiskey. So if you're partial to ginger, I would definitely recommend that one. One called Dublin Double Chocolate, and that's Guinness and Jameson whiskey. Kentucky Butter Pecan, and that's butter pecan with Kentucky bourbon. At this point, I probably have about 14 flavors on my menu.
Amazing. Well, I'm looking forward to getting maybe some pints brought home for me, because I tried the Kentucky bourbon one, the
butter pecan with Kentucky bourbon.
That one was amazing. And the float, we had a float with Guinness, and just delicious stuff. Congratulations on, you know, weathering the past year and on the success of the business. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to talk to you.
That was HMM's Corinne Carey speaking with Layla Kios, owner of Albany's Bar, Entertainment Center, and Ice Cream Shop, The Yard and Boozy Moos. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer tonight is Sina Bazila Hickey. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org and on our Facebook page at facebook.com/WOOC105.3FM. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call us at 518-272-2390. That's 518-272-2390. And if you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.